Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of the hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited today to be joined by Dr. Monica Nalepa to tell us all about her book titled After Authoritarianism, Transitional Justice and Democratic Stability, just out in 2022 from Cambridge University Press, which deals with a really tricky question of what actually should transitional justice look like after authoritarian regimes. And the book does some amazing work methodologically, theoretically, all sorts of different things to analyze different types of transitional justice and try and figure out how they actually work, what the benefits are, what the potential problems are, how they work individually in combination, and tests all of this using some very interesting modeling. So it's a very useful book on a lot of different levels, whether you are interested in policy or theory or modeling. There are many different ways to get your teeth into this book. And so I'm very excited to welcome you, Monica, to the podcast to tell us all about it.
Thank you so much. I'm very excited to be here.
Could you start us off, please, by introducing yourself a little bit and explaining why you decided to write this book?
Sure. So I'm a professor at the University of Chicago in the political science department, where I've been for 8 years now. But I actually hail from Poland. So I spent the first 23 years of my life in Warsaw, Poland, growing up as the transition from communist autocracy to democracy was happening. And issues of transitional justice were front and center. So while I was probably too young to take part in the very much grassroots toppling of the communist regime, and I was too young to even participate in protests, I was very much aware of the political surroundings as questions were arising, how to deal with the former members of the communist authoritarian regime, their collaborators, the secret police. And I remember very vividly how heated the conversation was, whether Poland should just move on and sort of have its eyes set on the future of joining international organizations, the EU, NATO, transitioning to a capitalist economy, or whether it should hold accountable those who committed pretty gruesome acts in the past. So that's what was going on around me. I was in college at the time, and when I came to the United States and started writing my doctoral thesis in political science, it actually turned out that this had left more of an imprint on me than I thought it had. But I had learned some very useful and interesting methods for analyzing political institutions while in graduate school. I think that those tools actually helped me to get a better grasp of the fact that transitional justice, which is what this basically set of mechanisms for dealing with former authoritarian elites and their collaborators refers to. I think what those tools allowed me to do is to study transitional justice, not so much as a normative question, what should be done to folks who committed atrocities and human rights violations in the past, but rather what kind of mechanisms are best for ensuring democratic stability of the new polity. Because after, at the end of the day, what we really care for following regime change is that the regime that follows, the democratic regime, that those institutions are as permanent as possible, and that backsliding back into authoritarianism does not happen. And the answer to the question of which kinds of mechanisms stabilize democracy will sometimes be very different than, you know, what kind of mechanism the public would like to see to hold former perpetrators accountable for justice to be done and so on. So I became fascinated with this positive set of questions, or positivist set of questions, if you will. And and that's why I wanted to write a book about it. And I also didn't want to write a book just about the Polish experience. I wanted it to have a broader appeal, and I actually wanted to place Poland in the context of other regime transitions, not just those in post-communist Europe, but also, in Eastern and Central Europe, but those around the world. So when in 2017, I received a grant from the National Science Foundation to create the Global Transitional Justice data set, the plans for writing a book started to become reality.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for explaining that to us. I think it obviously provides a really helpful kind of introduction to sort of what the book is trying to do. And it's also always just really interesting to kind of hear about how projects end up in their finished form. It's very easy to kind of pick the book off the shelf and be like, it must have always been like this. But of course, we know doing research that that's not how projects start off. And I think it's particularly helpful for any listeners who might be starting off with projects or starting off with their research journeys to hear a little bit about kind of how ideas can be shaped by multiple things, personal and professional experiences, etc., and kind of brought together into something. So thank you very much for starting us off with that lovely introduction. I obviously now want to move into discussing a lot of the topics in the book, and we're definitely not going to get into all of the detail that the book provides, unfortunately. But we can do, I think, a bit of a highlights tour to kind of hit the main things. So to provide foundation for this, can you introduce us to the transparency regimes that you focus on in the book?
Sure. So to do that, we have to remember that authoritarian regimes love secrets, right? So they're not as open as democracies. They employ a huge bloated enforcement apparatus called the secret police. Any polity has security services. So any polity will have enforcement members of their enforcement apparatus that do their work in secret. But in authoritarian regimes, those secret police apparatuses are much more bloated. Transparency regimes essentially uncover secrets of the former authoritarian regime. So they uncover who were the collaborators of the secret police, who were the informers, where those records were kept. And what I argue in the book is that the mechanisms of transitional justice that uncover secrets of the former authoritarian regime are key for ensuring democratic stability later on. And they do this for a very simple reason. Many of the secrets of the former authoritarian regime, especially those that involve collaboration of, say, dissidents with the said authoritarian regime, are very embarrassing to former dissidents to float to the surface. If a former dissident becomes a politician in the new democracy, as frequently happens, because those are, after all, the heroes of the revolution, if a secret comes to the surface that this dissident had collaborated as an informer with the secret police, this can destroy that politician's career. Such politicians may be willing actually to do a lot of things to keep such skeletons in the closet. And the only way to ensure that new politicians with such dissident and yet embarrassing pasts are not blackmailed by persons who have access to those secrets are transparency regimes. So basically, by unearthing secrets of the former authoritarian regime, a new democracy can ensure that those secrets won't be used to skew political outcomes through these tools of blackmail, of kompromat, and so on. One of the impetus for writing this book is because some of these transparency regimes were thrown into the same bag with transitional justice mechanisms that are in fact very different. So scholarship in the field tend to pull together all kinds of transitional justice mechanisms that deal with the secret, with the police and secret police. So we know that the former militias and police agencies of authoritarian regimes are frequently closed down by new democracies. But shutting down these institutions and firing their workers and hiring new ones, or banning members of the former communist or other authoritarian parties from running for office is very different than unearthing, say, than opening archives of the former secret police. They tend to be viewed similarly, and they're often called purges or lustration or vetting. But the mechanism of uncovering secrets and the mechanism for punishing for wrongdoing perpetrators and members of the former regime for things that everybody knew that they did are ultimately very different mechanisms. So I wanted to sort of draw, I wanted to write a book that would show that these mechanisms belong to, do different things and should be used and should not be treated as one and the same mechanism. Sometimes one is advisable and other times the other one is advisable.
Thank you for explaining kind of the different options and also sort of some of the problems that motivate the research, that there are not only different things that work in different ways, but perhaps some of the debates and work that's been done on this before haven't always sort of differentiated them, certainly not as clearly as you do in the book. And one of the strengths of the book, and you've obviously already mentioned it a little bit, so I'd love to ask you to tell us more, is this massive data set that you've been able to put together to really help unpick this. And as you say, make this not just a one country case study or investigation, but think much more broadly. So can you tell us more about the Global Transitional Justice data set and how you've created it?
Yeah, sure. So first of all, we had to create a new data set because as I mentioned, since purges and lustrations are typically pooled and treated as one mechanism by researchers who basically just think that because it deals with the police and enforcement apparatus, it should be just pulled together under one heading. So we had to create data from scratch where we separate lustrations on the one hand and purges on the other. And actually, we added to that two other mechanisms. But the other thing we wanted to do is collect data from all countries that were in a position to implement transitional justice. So what does it mean to be in a position to implement transitional justice? Well, it means to have transitioned from autocracy to a democratic regime, right? So we first took all the countries that were in that situation from since 1946. And then we chronologically reconstructed what kind of mechanisms were implemented in those countries. So we did this over time, and we decided to start at the date of the democratic transition, but continue going until the current times. And so we didn't actually treat, as many scholars have done so far, we didn't just look at the first 10 years following the transition, because we know that some countries actually embark on their transitional justice journeys much later. Spain is an excellent example here. Argentina is another. So we wanted to have a time series of these transitional justice events as they unfold, a disaggregated time series. So where these four mechanisms are separated. So what are the four mechanisms? So I've already talked a little bit about lustrations. So lustrations uncover those who the truth about those who collaborated with the secret police in secret. Then there are purges, and purges, let go from office those who collaborated or worked for the regime, but openly, so everybody knew who they were. They can be members of authoritarian parties, they can be workers of the police or secret police apparatus, but there's no new information that is released by conducting purges. But purges can be of two kinds, right? Purges can be, so when you have an enforcement apparatus of a authoritarian regime, you have its leadership, right? You have those who are giving orders, and then you have the rank and file who are performing those orders. And it's frequently often argued that the only thing one needs to do is just fire the leadership, right? Those who are giving orders. Rank and file members can just be retrained to follow other orders. But sometimes an argument is also made that no, actually sometimes an enforcement agency in an authoritarian regime is so, or bureaucracy of an authoritarian regime for that matter, is so compromised that there's just no point in trying to repurpose the rank and file, that the whole agency should just be closed down and new people should be trained and a new agency should be formed. So there are two types of purges that the Global Transitional Justice data set talks about. There are leadership purges and thorough purges. And then the fourth mechanism are truth commissions. So I have to admit that including truth commissions under transparency regimes has drawn a lot of criticism from people who very correctly point out that truth commissions do so much more than reveal secrets, right? They conduct hearings, they write reports, they travel the country sometimes to interact with victims, they make policy recommendations. I completely agree with that. Like, truth commissions do a whole lot more. But from the point of view of democratic stability and from the point of view of unearthing the secrets of the former authoritarian regime, that function of truth commissions is very similar to lustrations. So that's why they're subsumed under transparency regimes in the book.
Mm. That makes sense. And I see the criticism, but I also understand how it fits in with the rest of this. And it's very helpful to have laid out the four mechanisms in addition to obviously the very cool data set. So thank you for explaining both of those to us. We're obviously now going to kind of talk through some of those mechanisms in different ways. But obviously for anyone interested in like all of the details about a particular one, I will point you to the full book itself for that. But first up, can you tell us a bit more about what you found kind of in the theory and obviously in the data about how lustrations improve the quality of representation in democracies that are mm-hmm. coming out of authoritarian rule?
Yeah, of course. So this is a really key point because lustrations have been criticized following the transition to democracy in places that have embarked on them a lot. And the reason they have been criticized is because they often expose these very dark pasts of politicians, and often, you know, the politicians who have these pasts exposed are persons who have been for years trusted and, you know, and have actually sometimes glorious pasts in toppling the authoritarian regime. So why is it important that lustrations be carried out? I think we can all agree that in a democracy we want to elect into office politicians who have expertise, so know how to implement policy, but also are trusted, right? And we want to elect politicians who, once they are elected into office, will actually implement the things that they promised to implement when they were campaigning. But the argument I make in the book that lack of lustration can actually prevent that. If, as often happens following the toppling of an authoritarian regime, the new political elite is made up of former dissidents and those who oppose the authoritarian regime, it's very important to know who among those politicians have these dark secrets in their past. And the reason is because if those secrets are not unearthed, anybody with access to that information, and this could be a secret police officer, this could be a politician for whom that former secret police officer worked, can use that information to extract any kinds of concessions from those politicians. They can be rents, they can be policy concessions, they can be demands that are made on that politician in a form of blackmail, essentially. In return for keeping those secrets or those skeletons in the closet buried. Once lustration has taken place and once the archives of the secret police have been open and all candidates for public office have actually been vetted for whether or not they were secret police informers, the public knows with certainty that those who are holding office don't have such secrets, such skeletons in the closet, can be trusted, and as a result, democracy is better at representation. So that's in a nutshell what the theory says, with the help of a pretty simple game theoretic model. But then we also take this theory to data, and what we looked at is we looked at data on party programmaticness. So programmaticness is a bit of a mouthful, but essentially what it means is to what extent political parties run on programs and then stick to those programs. And what we found is that countries that had more severe or more intense lustration programs also have more programmatic parties. So it's actually true that in states that have had lustrations, that have embarked on these transparency mechanisms, the programmaticness of their parties, so the party's ability to stick to their programs, is also higher. And I think that this is some very powerful corroboration of this intuition that transparency helps democratic stability by making democratic representation tighter.
Mm. I think it's a very powerful example, the idea of kind of having secrets that can be an issue. And it's very easy to kind of immediately put this on kind of current political campaigns and go, yep, okay, I can see how that would be a problem. Definitely an immediate contribution of the book and a very key point. And I want to kind of then move to the part that you mentioned, sort of had a bit of critique, and ask you essentially the same sort of question about improving the quality of representation, but for truth commissions and what the mechanism is there.
Yeah, so the mechanism is actually theoretically is quite similar on the surface. So we have the same model to explain lustrations and truth commissions, but the technique for testing it has to be a little bit different. And it relates to the reason that I mentioned before, that truth commissions do so much more than just uncover the truth. They do more, and they also act faster. Right. So truth commissions are typically very public events. Right. If we look at the TRC, from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of South Africa as an example, it basically created this public spectacle of traveling around the country, broadcasting through the radio, through, I think it was the radio, I don't think it was the television, hearings with where perpetrators would provide full testimony to their crimes in the presence of victims. And then the commission wrote up a report. So it happened basically in the first few years of the transition. So I make the argument in the book that truth commissions are able to do more, but also sort of like act faster. Lustrations, on the other hand, have a very cumulative effect. So lustrations are restricted to the political class. That's probably the most important difference, that, you know, some countries lustrate professors, journalists, lawyers, but most lustrations around the world actually concentrate on those who are running for office. Not so for truth commissions. Truth commissions have this sort of like broad application across society. And because the effect of lustrations sort of has to accumulate over time, the kind of data that we use to test the effect of lustrations is cross-sectional data, right? So we actually measured the intensity of lustration as simply how many lustration events since the transition a given country has had. But with truth commissions, we actually exploited the whole time range since the transition. And we used a slightly different statistical model for testing the effect of truth commissions. And because truth commissions don't only affect politicians in political parties, we also used a different outcome variable. So as I mentioned with lustration, I looked at programmaticness, so how tightly parties follow their programs. But with truth commissions, instead we looked at two variables that that I argue are very good at assessing democratic stability. On the one hand, political corruption and how that changes over time. And I drew on an excellent data source, The Varieties of Democracy, the VDEM data set. And another variable that I looked at is power distributed by socioeconomic status, which is an awful mouthful, I know, but it's actually a very simple concept. So power distributed by socioeconomic status, or PDSES for short, measures to what extent people who are richer also have more political power. So it measures the association between between wealth and political power, and it's a good tool to assess the extent to which democracy has stabilized, because in democracies, ideally, we think of those two things as independent, right? In autocracies, in contrast, political power and wealth tend to go together. And what we find is that countries that have more truth commissions have better scores on democratic stability according to those two measures, political corruption and power distributed by socioeconomic status. So truth commissions operate through a similar mechanism. They also reveal secrets and in that sense, safeguard against blackmail. But they do it differently over time than lustrations.
I think that's definitely a power of being able to use the data to show different things. And similarly, I'm wondering if you can tell us about kind of, we've obviously talked about them in relation to each other, lustrations and truth commissions, but also kind of individually. What happens if countries do both?
So interestingly, few countries do both, right? It seems that there's that it's what social scientists or economists call, there's a substitution effect between lustrations and truth commissions. If you use lustrations, you're going to use less truth commissions. If you use truth commissions, you're going to use less lustrations. It seems that lustrations are the transitional justice mechanism of choice. In democracies following autocracies that had a long tenure. Why is that? Autocracies that have a long tenure have sort of like more time to move away from brute violent force in staying in power and consolidating their rule in lieu of surveillance, propaganda, infiltration, instead of actually repressing opposition when it surfaces, when it's directly threatening their rule. They like to see signs of a discontent early on through a bloated secret police apparatus. And these bloated secret police apparatuses will be very active in recruiting informers, collaborators, and so on and so on. The tools for uncovering who was and who was not a secret collaborator are lustration mechanisms. On the flip side, autocracies that do repress, do use brute violent force, perpetrate more human rights violations, those former autocracies following the transition to democracy will more frequently turn to truth commissions. So that just seems to be a sort of almost natural pattern that we see truth commissions following short-lived autocracies, lustrations following long-lived autocracies that relied on the secret police.
Hmm. Interesting. I'm wondering if there's some sort of Goldilocks length that would result in a country choosing both. Probably
that's
not.
That would be a great question to ask. And the Global Transitional Justice data set actually, which is publicly available mm-hmm. on the website of the Transitional Justice and Democratic Stability Lab .com, is available for download and could be used to find that Goldilocks number of years that an autocratic regime has to last to switch from truth commissions as the optimal transitional justice mechanisms to lustrations.
Great. That sounds like someone's MA dissertation right there. So there we go, another contribution. Moving then to your next mechanism, or one of the other four mechanisms, tell us about purges, and particularly the kind of scale of them, wide scale or not. What determines kind of how big a purge countries might use?
Yeah, so whether wide-scale purges or leadership purges are chosen will largely there's two questions here. One is what countries actually do, and second, what should they do? The usability of former authoritarian bureaucrats and former authoritarian members of the enforcement apparatus depends critically on how good they were at their job while they were still in an authoritarian regime. And by how good they were, I don't mean how good they were in upholding the authoritarian regime, but they also often ran the state. So there are many many former bureaucrats who worked for the authoritarian state that have very usable skills that can be easily repurposed by the new democracy. And firing them sometimes is actually the new democracy shooting itself in the foot. So doing something that it will regret, because how can a new democracy staff all these agencies and all these bureaucracies and all these departments with people who are essentially untrained how to run the state? I mean, it could probably staff them and then start training them, but particularly in the first years following transition, when there is chaos, when the institutions are weak, those are exactly the years and the time when you actually do want to have at least some people with experience on how to run things. So the trade-off that the new democracy faces is basically, you know, how far do we purge these bureaucracies and these enforcement apparatuses? And how far they purge will depend on how institutionalized the bureaucracy and the enforcement apparatus of the previous authoritarian regime was. Sometimes it was not institutionalized at all. Sometimes in order to get a job in an authoritarian bureaucracy, all you had to do is have some loyalty ties to the autocrat. Sometimes you were rewarded for your contributions to your personal contributions to the dictator. In cases like this, a purge is not costly at all, right? Those people were only working there because the dictator liked them, because they did something for that autocrat. They didn't have expertise. They weren't particularly good at implementing policy. So that they can be let go freely. And that purges in those circumstances will actually stabilize the democracy. But if you're purging actually people who, you know, fought corruption in the previous authoritarian regime, why can't they fight corruption in the new democratic regime? Maybe with a little bit of retraining, right? Especially if you're also transitioning economies from a socialist planned economy to a capitalist economy, the notion of corruption between the two changes a little bit. But it seems like such a waste to be firing all those people. And in the case of enforcement apparatuses, it's even there's a second consideration to take into account, which is, you know, people working in enforcement apparatuses are at the end of the day experts in conducting violence. So letting them go en masse, where you fire every single member of, say, a security apparatus, that can actually be risky, because you're now letting loose on the streets of a new democratic regime people who, you know, are thugs and know how to use violence, mm-hmm. and you're not giving them an alternative task to perform.
See Iraq, for example.
Absolutely. So no wonder they will form criminal organizations, right? No wonder they will, you know, they will allow themselves to get hired as mercenaries and so on. So there's that double risk, actually, of conducting thorough purges in these new democratic contexts. And it's, if I can just like add one more thing, it's a normatively very discomforting point, right? Because what the book is essentially saying is sometimes for democratic stability to hold, you actually might want to not so much forgive, but not apply transitional justice to those people who very openly supported the regime, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes you actually might want to have them stay in the structures of the state where you can see them. But on the other hand, it seems that the wrath of transitional justice is often concentrated on those who fought the authoritarian regime, but just, you know, by a momentary lapse of reason, slipped and fell and, you know, and informed on their fellow dissidents. And now they're former collaborators and they have these secrets. It's actually better from the point of view of democratic stability to reveal the secrets about those former dissidents than to fire from the positions absolutely every single member of the police enforcement apparatus, for instance. So this gives a lot of people pause, because what our normative instincts seem to tell us is, no, we should be punishing the, you know, like the thugs, the openly collab, the open members of the former authoritarian regime, right? But it seems that, you know, that the that transitional justice that stabilizes democracy is often that TJ, that, sorry, I just used the acronym, which, you know, which is aimed at those who brought about democracy. So that's, that's the kind of sad note on which the book ends.
Well, but that's not where our interview is going to end, because I have many other things to ask you about. So I was wondering, that's kind of a really helpful way of understanding sort of what the use of purges is and sort of what the different factors are for determining what kind of purge to use. Could you maybe round off this bit about purges and explain to us kind of what the three factors you determine are really key for whether purges actually work or not?
Yeah, so the most important factor is whether whether the previous authoritarian the previous authoritarian regime's enforcement apparatus or bureaucracy was institutionalized, right? So how good those holding positions in the former authoritarian regime really were. A secondary consideration is how different that authoritarian regime was from the new democracy. So we kind of like think that, well, one is an authoritarian regime, the other one is a democracy. Obviously they're different, but by how different, I mean sort of spatially, how different their, you know, their policy choices would have been. So it's entirely possible that towards the, you know, towards the end of the authoritarian regime, the people in leadership, those you know, at the helm of the state, were actually more moderate than, you know, those, for instance, who were establishing the authoritarian regime. So, you know, I'm thinking right now of, you know, Poland in the 80s, right? Post-martial law Poland in the 80s. You know, like the prime minister was almost you know, almost pro-European. Or, you know, if you think about Hungary, even more so, right? They even had some free market ideas that they tried to, that they were implementing at the time. And in turn, the first set of elites that took over power in post-communist Europe were also pretty moderate. So the distance between the preferences of people running the enforcement apparatuses and bureaucracies and the authoritarian regimes of the 80s in Europe were really not that distant from the preferences of members of the democratic elites in Europe. So that is also a reason why, you know, purges might be less necessary, because there's not really that much difference in terms of ideological distance between the successors of the authoritarian regime and the new democracy. But in contrast, there might be states where actually there's a 180 shift from the former autocracy to democracy. That might be a consideration for actually letting those members of the enforcement apparatus and bureaucracy go. And the third factor, which is, you know, which we kind of like take as a given in any democratic transition, is uncertainty, right? So why do we actually need members of enforcement apparatuses and members of bureaucracies with expertise? Well, we need them because they know how to react to changing situations. So if a politician wants to implement a policy, that implementation can be sabotaged simply by circumstances. So the greater this uncertainty is, the greater the call for agents who have this necessary expertise. So again, these three factors: how institutionalized was the previous authoritarian regime, how much uncertainty there is, and what is the ideological distance between the previous authoritarian leaders of the previous authoritarian regime and leaders of the new democratic regime? Those are three factors that will determine to what extent purges should be implemented.
Hmm. Okay. Well, that makes rather a lot of sense. And in fact, on this idea of kind of, you know, the preferences of the individuals, like, that does to an extent matter. And they're definitely not going to be the same at the end versus at the beginning. And this kind of goes into the part of the book where you talk about personnel transitional justice mechanisms, and specifically around the idea of career trajectories of individual members of the authoritarian elite, many of whom will try and go into politics. And you've kind of outlined where lustration can be effective in that. But you also talk about this in terms of business and the private sector. So can you help us understand how these different mechanisms impact those kinds of career trajectories for individuals?
Yeah, so I think that this is something that we really need to appreciate more in the context of regime changes. I like to, since I teach in the United States, you know, I like to tell my students that the U.S. following its war of independence, which is basically the only opportunity that the U.S. had to implement transitional justice, was when it was or transparency mechanisms rather, when it was trying to uncover who was a collaborator of the British during the war of independence. But really, the U.S. did not have a problem of transitional justice because all of the British loyalists towards transitional justice would be implemented left. So they had this very convenient exit option of just leaving. Most countries transitioning from authoritarianism to democracy do not have that luxury. The former elites and rank and file members who supported the authoritarian regime either secretly or openly are all left in the same country. And one has to deal with them one way of another. So not doing transitional justice is also a transitional justice choice. And what I do towards the end of the book is, again, with the help of my amazing Transitional Justice and Democratic Stability Lab, so the same group of students who helped me collect the global transitional justice data set, is we track down the leadership of authoritarian regimes, and we looked at what they did with their lives following the transition. And we tried to find them in business, we tried to find them in political parties, in state positions. We also tried to see how many actually ended up having their day in court and being held responsible, either for human rights violations that they committed in the past or just for corrupt activity. And we saw, and then we looked at what kind of, what transitional justice mechanisms were associated with these different fates of former political elites. And we found some really interesting correlations. So this is purely cross-sectional. We're not able to actually say exactly, we're not able to provide direct evidence of how these different transitional justice mechanisms affected where these elites went. But we find, for instance, that that lustrations, even though they move these former, so lustrations, first of all, recall, they should not really affect known leadership of the former authoritarian regime, because lustrations uncover secrets, right? Former authoritarian secrets. So they don't have a direct effect on people who ran the former authoritarian state. Everybody knew who the, you know, first secretaries, the Politburos, and so on were. But what we find is that lustrations actually move elites into business. Okay. So they don't show up in the state, they don't show up in political parties, but they do tend to show up more in business ventures. And and we looked at other correlations as well, but this is basically the tail end of the book where you know, we sort of just did this exercise that I initially called de facto versus de jure transitional justice, where, you know, there's the de jure transitional justice, which talks about, you know, legislation that mandates lustration, legislation that mandates truth commissions or purges, and then you have the actual information of where the elites go. Later, I abandoned that term a little bit because it's misleading in the sense that it only is concerned with leadership. But as I mentioned before, transitional justice, the subjects of transitional justice are not just the leaders of the former authoritarian regime, but essentially everybody who supported it. So, so that's... does that answer your question?
It does. And I think it's very interesting. I was able to interview an author a few months ago who wrote a book about the gray men, the Stasi agents in East Germany, and kind of what happened to them and mostly what justice did not happen to them. And he had all sorts of examples about them moving over into the private sector. And a lot of it was because of lack of lustration. There were all these secrets kept. And so there were a bunch of people that later on were found out to have been involved in things. But at the time they weren't, it wasn't known. So they could go amass big fortunes and then be safe from prosecution later on, which in a lot of ways kind of illustrates these types of things you're talking about.
So that's fascinating. And it's actually really closely related to one of the things that I talk about as well, which is, you know, when Stasi officers or rank and file members of this bloated secret police apparatus are fired and they're not given employment anywhere. So negatively verified secret police officers in Poland, for instance, couldn't find employment in the security service or in the police, right? So if you're an expert in violence, an expert in, you know, surveillance, and you cannot find employment in the police, you cannot find employment in the security service, what are you going to do with your skills? And, you know, and I think, you know, going into all kinds of shady economic operations, organized crime, I mean, that is your exit option. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, any policymaker deciding on what kind of transitional justice policy to embark on has to realize that doing nothing also has consequences.
Well, so speaking of policy decision making, what would happen if we put together all four of these transitional justice mechanisms?
Oh, at the same intensity.
Well,
I would say, so there's this temptation actually to, you know, like if you're going to have lustrations, if you're going to expose secrets, then you should also punish the, you know, the former workers of the police, the enforcement apparatus, the bureaucracy. Like, why only punish the dissidents? But it seems like if you did everything at once, you would basically be starting with a tabula rasa, right? Your new democracy would be starting truly from scratch. I don't know that a lot of democracies have that luxury because, you know, and here I'm mostly speaking from, you know, my own experiences of, you know, growing up in Warsaw of the 90s. It was such an unstable time. Such a dangerous time. And, you know, it's interesting that only like years later when I'm, you know, working on new projects and reading up on, you know, organized crime in Eastern Europe that I'm just realizing, you know, how dangerous surroundings I was growing up in. I don't think that those are the times when you want to be, you know, rebuilding your institutions from scratch. It's also sorry to say this, it's kind of an academic question because we actually don't see countries that had high intensity on all four mechanisms. There seem to be these trade-offs, as I mentioned before, lustrations or truth commissions, you know, thorough purges or leadership purges. So thorough purges and leadership purges can't go together because, you know, if you're doing a leadership purge and a rank and file purge, then you're doing a thorough purge. So it's always one or the other. But the trade-off with lustrations and truth commissions is definitely there, as you mentioned.
Mm. Well, I think this is, again, one of the powerful contributions of the book, that it doesn't stay in the realm of theory and kind of goes, so we have these things that we've theorized, but actually let's look at what's practically happening and what's practically possible. So I'm glad you made that point because I think it's a very important one. But you did also mention next projects. So I was wondering perhaps if, as my last question, I could ask you to tell us a little bit about anything you might be working on now or next.
Yeah, excellent. So I'm very excited to tell you about this because after authoritarianism is definitely a global transitional justice project. And I had tons of fun putting together the data set and we're planning the second and third release of the data set this fall and winter. In the meantime, the Polish Institute of National Remembrance, which I interviewed archivists from when I was writing my first and my second book, has publicized on the internet essentially the whole contents of the archives of the secret police. So it's Ooh. Made specifically available personnel files of thousands of secret police officers who worked for the communist authoritarian regime and who had a chance to apply to be vetted or verified by vetting commissions that were created throughout Poland in 1990. And we also have transcripts of the deliberations of the vetting commissions. So the next project is about it kind of like goes away from global and zooms into a specific country and a specific case of transitional justice, namely purges. And it treats purges as an example of police reform, right? So we talk about a lot about police reform in the US, I know in the UK also, but purges of the enforcement apparatus of a former authoritarian regime is also a form of police reform. So what this next project does is first it explains what the challenges facing these vetting commissions were. You know, so on the one hand, they wanted to have a functional police. On the other hand, they wanted to, you know, punish the worst thugs and so on. And then it shows what consequences those decisions had. And when I say consequences, I mean both consequences for crime, right? So ultimately, you know, like you want an enforcement apparatus that is going to keep crime down, but also for trust towards the police. So we use this this Poland in the context of regime change as a micro study of the effects of police reform. And this is a project that I'm co-authoring with a very talented professor from King's College London, Barbara Piotrowska. Mm. And during this past year, we've been organizing data, talking about theories, and you know, we hope this is going to be the next book that maybe I'll be talking with you about in a few years.
You've just preempted my invitation, so do let us know when that becomes a book, and thank you for giving us a sneak peek of it. But while you are off working on that, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, which again is titled After Authoritarianism, Transitional Justice and Democratic Stability, out just now in 2022 from Cambridge University Press. Monica, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. This was wonderful.